Hello, thank you for joining us today. We will be interviewing Mr. Daniel Biot, who has worked for a long time at UN Habitat. And as he reaches the end of his career, will be giving us key insights and explanations on his experience within the organization. Good morning, Mr. Daniel Biot.
Yes, good morning.
Could you please introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yes, thank you. Yes, my name is Daniel Biot. I've worked for Habitat for 23 years. I started on the 29th February 1988, and I worked until the end of March 2011, that is 23 years. At the beginning, I was working at the Africa unit of Habitat, in charge of Francophone Africa. Then I was promoted to the post of Director of Technical Cooperation in 1994, and I remained at that post for 17 years. Also, during the year 98 to 2005, during the phase of revitalization of Habitat, I acted as a deputy executive director of the organization, and I, in fact, worked in different parts of the organization in addition to technical cooperation. So I think I have known Habitat for a long time, and I have known a lot of colleagues and friends, and I want to, from the start, say thank you to all of them for their friendship, their support, and their very nice collaboration over these years.
So learning these lessons and sharing them with us can help both the colleagues who are working in Habitat at the present or who have worked there in the past, as well as people who are planning to or hoping to work in such organizations in the future. However, what is your particular intention for conducting these informal talks?
Yes, in fact, this was a kind of request from a few colleagues. We were talking at the coffee station, and they said, oh yes, you have spent a lot of time with Habitat, you have known all managers of Habitat, and it would be nice that you leave something behind you, and that you are just not leaving on a kind of a farewell party without some living documentation. And after talking with them, I noticed that we are all fed up of written reports, and that a quite old-fashioned but also innovative way of leaving something behind would be just to record, not on a TV show, but to record on a CD or on an audio tape, my experience with Habitat. Of course, this is a very informal talk. This is not for broad dissemination, this is only for colleagues, present colleagues, past colleagues, and maybe for future colleagues. And this is a bit my contribution to the institutional memory of Habitat. In fact, I have been always impressed by an old African say in French, from West Africa in French, quand un vieillard meurt, c'est une bibliothèque qui brûle, which you can translate that when an old man dies, is like a library burning. Of course, I'm not dying, but I think my career has reached a turning point, and I think it will be good to keep this kind of virtual library alive. And this is why I'm quite happy to report, to speak to you and my colleagues on this series of talks.
Thank you. Now, for those of our listeners who are rather unfamiliar with the UN system, UN Habitat is a rather small agency and is little known. Nonetheless, it is part of the UN system. What is the general UN role in international affairs? Can you give us a brief introduction to that, as well as to the specific role of UN Habitat?
Yes, well, in fact, this would be for the newcomers to the UN. We all know that the UN organization was founded at the San Francisco Conference of 1945, and then the UN headquarters was established a few months later in New York. At the start, the only objective of the UN was the promotion of peace, to avoid that a new world war would occur. And this was really peace building, peacekeeping in 1945. Now, with the independence of many developing countries in the late 50s, early 60s, the second objective which was brought to the UN was the objective of promoting development, human development. And these are now, since the 60s, the two main objectives of the UN, peace and development, and habitat belongs to the development side of the United Nations. Of course, development and peace are closely interrelated, because in principle, development should promote peace by definition. If you are developing, you are not fighting. So, we are on the development side of the UN. And I would say our specificity is to combine the technical side of development with the political side of development. You are in the UN, you are supposed to be experts in the UN Secretariat, but you are also supposed to take into account the political situation in the countries where you intervene, but also the political negotiation on the global arena, that is, the political problems of the world. You cannot work in a vacuum. You are not an NGO, you are not a research center, you are the United Nations Secretariat. So we have to be the official, in fact, the official voice of the world, which is quite challenging. We have to be experts, but we have also to be somehow politician. This doesn't mean that we just have to follow member states. We have to be a step ahead. That's a very important thing, particularly for new staff member. You have to be a little bit ahead of member states. That is, you have to propose new option, new solution. Of course, not too innovative, but just innovative enough to make a difference. We cannot ignore the negotiation, we cannot ignore the global views of member states, but we have to be proactive to promote some new ideas and new options. And to do that, we have to feel the political stakes. We cannot ignore politics. Sometimes these political stakes are very broad, sometimes they are even beyond our field of human settlements, but we have to take them into account. This was, for instance, very clear when we negotiated the guidelines on decentralization. We had to take into account the situation in every member state as far as relationship between central and local government are concerned. The step ahead means also that we have to remember always, to keep in mind always, the first words of the UN Charter. The preamble of the UN Charter starts with, "We the people of the United Nations." We the peoples means that the UN encompass more than the governments alone. The UN should also take into account the peoples themselves. That is, governments and peoples. Of course, peoples are not represented, are not voting powers, but we have to take their interest into account. That's also something extremely important, which were, and this first words of the preamble have been repeated consistently by all UN Secretary General. This is a key message of the United Nations. As far as Habitat itself is concerned, we are just a small agency among many. In fact, in the development field, there are probably at least 20 agencies of the UN working together, sometimes in competition. We, at Habitat, we are more on the environmental side, and this way also we are in Nairobi since our creation in 1978. Nairobi being the only headquarters of the UN in the developing world, and also hosting our sister agency of UNEP, the United Nations Environment Programme. We are based in Kenya, and in fact this was the best option in the 70s to open the UN to the developing world. This is something which is also specific of Habitat. We are small, but we are properly located in Africa and really in contact with the problems of the developing world.
So, if I've understood correctly, the raison d'être of UN Habitat and of the UN agencies in general is both technical and political, and therefore being able to represent the political voice of many different countries is one of the key comparative advantages of the UN system compared to other organizations such as development banks or international development organizations. However, is there any other advantage of being part of the UN machinery Does this provide any opportunities, or is it sometimes more of a hindrance?
In fact, our comparative advantage is certainly not our size. We are, in fact, extremely small. I mean, many people have noticed that the total membership, the staffing of the UN, total staffing of the United Nations Secretariat is less than the staffing of the fire brigade of New York City. So our size is not an advantage. In fact, we are extremely small. Our expertise, which is quite recognized, is not even a comparative advantage, because many universities and research centers have also a lot of expertise in human settlements. I would say it's very clear to me after so many years that our comparative advantage is the blue flag, the UN flag. And the UN flag is extremely respected in the developing world, because it means neutrality, objectivity, and accountability. We cannot be compared to a university or a technical research center. In fact, we are not even doing research. We are only synthesizing research undertaken by others. We are on top. Normally, we should be on top of the world knowledge. We have to be informed. We have to synthesize. We have to know what is going on around the world, and we have to become the voice of the world. That's the point. Of course, there are many obstacles. I mean, the first obstacle is, of course, the UN bureaucracy. The UN bureaucracy, which is very heavy, which has a lot of rules and regulation, and which is not encouraging innovation and exchange of experience. That's well known, and I will talk of it later in our discussion. Another constraint or obstacle is the language barriers, because the UN works essentially in English, and English is the language of only 10-20% of the world population. For instance, in Asia, very few countries are using English as their national language, apart maybe from India and Singapore and countries like that. But I would say, generally speaking, we are quite poor in dealing with non-English speaking countries and mobilizing their experience. That's another barrier. But independently of these barriers, we are able to cross-fertilize. That is, we are able to take the experience of one country for the benefit of another one. We can organize seminars, we are organizing workshops, international conference meetings, training, to make sure that the good experience in one country can benefit another country. We are guided by the interest of the poor. That's very important for the UN. We are guided by the peoples, which means by the poor people in priority. What we do is a mixture, in terms of function, is a mixture of monitoring, training, awareness raising, policy discussion, testing in pilot projects. So we do a lot of things which combine together result in supporting developing countries and transition countries. This could be in the case of habitat building houses, but it can be more importantly in designing policy. We have to advise, we have to support. We cannot replace government, of course. We are demand driven, as we always say. Without requests, we cannot work. So we are not at all an NGO. We are the UN, the only international organization which can combine these dimensions of expertise with neutrality, objectivity, and accountability.
So how do all these tasks of helping governments and formulating best practices really unfold in practice?
In fact, in practice, we, as I said, we help government. By governments, in fact, I should clarify that we help central, regional, local governments. There are different levels of government, of course. And the main task, the main responsibility, is to help them in designing, implementing, monitoring, evaluating housing and urban development policies. Our legitimacy arises from the discussion in the General Assembly or in the Governing Council of Habitat. This is where member states discuss and agree on key policy principles. The best discussion was in Istanbul in 1996, when member states adopted the Habitat Agenda, which is a set of policy principles which are accepted by every country in the planet, which means that this is a set of principles that we, as Secretariat of the UN, should promote all over the world. This is a normative perspective, if you will, of UN Habitat, of the UN system in general. Every agency has to promote a number of values, a number of principles, and this we do it at global level, internationally, at regional level, which is extremely important because in the region, like Africa or Asia, countries share a lot of common aspects, a lot of common constraints and assets and advantages and difficulties. But we do it, I would say, primarily at national level. That is, we have to support the development of national policy and to support the implementation of this national policy through proper capacities. And then finally, at the local level, at city level, we have also to develop cities and support the development of cities with the local authorities. So you see, we work at different levels, always guided by the needs of the poor. The main activities, I would say, national activities, are what we call technical cooperation. That is, we define a program of cooperation with a country. We raise the funds for this program because Habitat is not a funding agency. So we raise the funds and we work for 2 years, for 3 years with this country to improve their human settlements by a number of policy reforms and by building the required capacities. These countries I'm talking about are, of course, least developed countries first, but also emerging economies and even well-developed countries like the countries of the Middle East. So we have worked in Habitat, in particularly in my division in technical cooperation, with all kinds of countries of the world, from the poorest to the richest, from N'Djamena to Dubai. So this is also something which is extremely important in terms of exchange of experience.
So it seems that many of your programs, for instance, are relatively similar to programs conducted, for example, by the World Bank or other international organizations, and that the biggest difference, as you mentioned, was that you are not a funding organization. So there could be some confusion here. Are you simply like the World Bank, but with less money? Or is there, I assume there is much more to UN Habitat and to the UN?
Yes, between the UN and the World Bank, or rather the Bretton Woods institution, including the IMF, is on one side, we need with technical assistance, that is the UN, and financial assistance, which is the World Bank. So technical assistance versus financial assistance. But I would say this is not the main difference. The main difference is that the UN is really based on multilateralism. That is, in the UN, we like to say one country has one vote. In the banks, all banks, including the World Bank, $1 has one vote. So that means that the main contributor to the banks, like the United States or the European Union, have the, I would say, the direction of the World Bank, the direction of the multilateral banks, while in the UN, the discussion is much more, is much broader, is more consensual. Every country has the same say in the negotiation. Of course, if you bring more money, you have more say, but basically, in terms of, in political analysis, the UN is the only multilateral organization of the world. With all its constraints, this is why recently you have seen the creation of the G20, which claimed to replace more or less the UN on key issues, but which has no secretariat, no organization, which is just a talk shop. The UN is multilateralism. This is our pride, in fact. Some countries don't like multilateralism. For instance, during the Bush administration, clearly the United States were really against the United Nations and tried their best to undermine the organization. But generally speaking, we provide recognition to some countries. We provide shame to other countries, including in human settlements. We produced a report on the eviction in Zimbabwe, for instance, which was very good and which described what was the policy of the regime. We tried to offer our assistance to this country with little success. We promote the good practice, for instance, of China in terms of urban management and housing. We also try to encourage the exchange of this practice between countries. So all this is not done by the banks. I mean, the banks are essentially funding programs and projects. And I would say, in terms of the World Bank or regional banks, they are more focused on middle class, generally speaking, on middle class and heavy infrastructure, while we are more focused on the urban poor, on the reduction of urban poverty. So we have a lot in common, we have a lot of joint program, but we have our own multilateral image, which I think makes a difference.
Thank you for this introduction to the UN system and to UN Habitat in particular. This concludes our first chapter, and thank you for listening.